Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's April 21st, 2015 8th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 3, Current Hedge Fund Environment, Institutional Investor Manager Perspectives. Jed Wider, Ethan Johnson, and Christopher Lutowski will discuss the current hedge fund terms and conditions environment from the perspective of institutional investors and hedge fund managers. Now, on to the podcast.
So good morning. This panel is the Institutional Investor Manager Perspectives. I'm joined on this panel by Ethan Johnson, to my left from our Miami and New York offices, and Christopher Lutowski from our New York office as well. We're going to spend a few minutes this morning focusing on a variety of different issues. We're going to cover some fiduciary duty issues, identification and exculpation provisions and what we're seeing in the marketplace, what we're seeing on the MFN side, some amendment issues, and then we're going to take a look at the use of independent directors on the offshore side, the use of either an LLC or an LP for the investment advisor, and then we'll take a quick look at some Volcker issues as well. So Chris will lead us off.
Thank you, Jed. To start off, what we thought we would do is focus on what we're seeing in the marketplace in terms of duties of investment managers, whether they're general partners or managers, as well as the demands from investors with respect to the sharing and allocation of burdens and liabilities between investors and fund managers. We thought we'd focus on what trends we're seeing in terms of fiduciary duties, standards of care, exculpation, indemnification of fund managers by the funds, indemnification of the funds by investors, as well as investor givebacks, and then turn to various rights and controls that investors are demanding in terms of expanding rights, MFN, and changes in rights in amendments. With respect to commingled funds, particularly Delaware limited partnerships and Delaware limited liability companies, under common law, managers have a duty of care and a duty of loyalty. But under the respective statutes, the DROLPA and the Delaware Limited Liability Company Act, those duties can be changed. And first, the duties that arise under common law can be eliminated or expanded or restricted. And then the liability for breaching those duties can also be similarly be limited or eliminated, except that a manager cannot eliminate their liabilities or their duties with respect to a breach of good faith and fair dealing. What we're seeing in the marketplace is that most commingled funds, as most people here are very aware, do not affirmatively acknowledge a particular fiduciary duty or even a standard of care, except in certain limited instances where it is an ERISA benefits plan fund, or unless the fund is a startup, or where the investor has strategic influence over the defining what the standard of care is. At the same time, most commingled funds do not expressly or clearly restrict or otherwise change the fiduciary duty. What they do is limit the liability for a breach of the fiduciary duty through the exculpation provision. We're not seeing many changes in terms of trends in the carve-outs to exculpation provisions within the commingled fund space. Typical carve-outs are gross negligence, fraud, willful misconduct. Minority funds have expanded that to include a material breach of the agreement or violation of law. And where the fund documents do not expressly eliminate or modify the fiduciary duty, even though the exculpation provision may limit their liability for damages, those are monetary damages, the managers will still have potential claims for injunctive or other equitable claims for breach of fiduciary duty. What we're seeing is that certain large institutional investors are demanding that managers, even if they've exculpated themselves from a breach of fiduciary duty, particularly the duty of loyalty, are demanding and focusing on conflicts. So how are managers ensuring that they're not breaching the duty of loyalty with respect to their investors? We're seeing a lot of focus at the due diligence stage in terms of DDQs, the disclosure of conflicts, increasing focus on review of conflicts provisions in the PPM, investor demands through side letter provisions for disclosure of conflicts, and also as part of the due diligence process, an attempt to identify whether or not the fund has engaged in principal or other related transactions. So as well as the SEC having a focus on conflicts as the prior two panels focused on, investors are as well. We're seeing a trend though on the other side with respect to captive funds. So in terms of investors who are investing through captive funds, they're very large institutional investors. Those can be governmental plans, ERISA plans, endowments, foundations, foreign institutional investors. And they are demanding an affirmative standard of care and some fiduciary duties, particularly those investors like governmental plans that are subject to statutory fiduciary duties. They are imposing those fiduciary standards by contract. And we've also seen increasing requests and demands by investors that aren't subject to a particular fiduciary duty or standard of care for a prudent man standard through contract. And those standards of care are then reflected in the carve-out to the exculpation provision. Certain captive funds that have exculpation provisions will then add a carve-out to the exculpation to the fact that if the manager breaches the fiduciary standard, a much higher standard than gross negligence, exculpation provision doesn't apply. Some investors take that further and say, I'm not agreeing to an exculpation provision at all. I just want you to have a liability provision where you're liable for that breach of that particular standard of care and a breach of the fiduciary standards as defined in the agreement.
Now, on the identification side, the vast majority of commingled funds permit identification of the GP or the manager for losses subject to a carve-out. Typical carve-out being gross negligence, willful misconduct, bad faith, fraud. Some funds will limit the applicability of the carve-out further to a final adjudication by a court of applicable law of the standards that are in the carve-out. And some funds tend to expand the carve-out a little further, including to a breach of the standard of care, material breach of the fund document, violation of applicable law or regulation, which is often limited to securities laws, or other criminal wrongdoing, a felony, for example. Some funds will provide identification of the GP or the manager for losses resulting from actions or omissions of fund service providers. But most LPs tend to push back on that, requiring that the GP or the manager be provided in identification only if it's selected and engaged, and sometimes also monitored the service provider with reasonable care. Now, on the fund of one side, many fund of one investors require that their captive fund managers not be entitled to indemnity. For those fund of one investors that do indemnify their GPs or managers, the identification provisions in the agreements often contain various terms that are more expansive than what you would typically see with respect to the commingled funds. These carve-outs generally include breach of the fiduciary standard, but as typical in many private equity funds, you also tend to see other types of provisions. The payment of indemnification advances or expense reimbursements sometimes require prior approval of the investor. The identified parties are frequently required to return amounts received if a final judgment determines they're not entitled to the indemnity. Identified parties are often required to exhaust all other sources of recovery. And sometimes the identified parties are often required to agree to return amounts received from the fund to the extent of amounts received from alternative sources, such as insurance policies or other types of indemnification sources. Now, on the funding side, we're seeing investors asking for certain identification provisions historically seen also in the private equity space. So how do you fund the identification? What conditions do you impose? Where do you look first to fund the identification before you look to the fund's assets? On the commingled side, most commingled funds do not require that the amounts of indemnification advances or expense reimbursements be paid first from available funds of insurance policies. And then to the extent that those insurance funds are not available, you then look to the assets of the fund. A minority of commingled funds will agree to this funding requirement by side letter, but most funds still express reluctance to impose these types of restrictions on the sourcing with respect to identification payments. On the fund of one side, most fund of ones will typically mandate that the GP or the manager look to all other sources of available recovery before looking to the assets of the fund. Some commingled funds and captive funds with an indemnification provision sometimes affirmatively limit the fund's obligations to pay indemnification amounts where the payment would result in the indemnified party receiving an aggregate amount that exceeds the party's losses. Now, on conditions on indemnification advances and expense reimbursements, the question really is, when are advances and reimbursements required to be returned? On the commingled side, most commingled funds do not impose conditions on the payment of indemnification advances or expense reimbursements. Some will, as a condition to paying advances, require that the indemnified party agree in advance to return any indemnification amounts if the party is not successful in the relevant action or claim for indemnity. A minority of funds also add a condition that the party agree in advance to return to the fund an amount of proceeds received up to the indemnification amount in order to prevent double dipping. And some funds will also agree by side letter to some of those provisions as well. Most fund of ones typically include these types of conditions. And we're certainly seeing an increase in requests by LPs for the return of these types of conditions. On the notice side, most commingled funds do not include a provision requiring notice of the indemnification claim, simple notice of the indemnification claim. We are seeing more investors requesting notice. To the extent that a commingled fund does agree to provide comfort with regard to this, either in a side letter or otherwise, typically those requests are qualified by either notice being provided upon request or notice being provided with respect to only material claims. There's a certain monetary threshold that's established. Or notice is provided on a periodic basis, such as quarterly or monthly. On the fund of one side, we typically see prompt notice being provided or mandated by LPs of their GPs with respect to any indemnification claim. And then lastly, with regard to reports of amounts of the indemnification advances and expense reimbursements, most commingled funds do not include a provision in their fund docs. Many investors will request some level of periodic reporting, and we typically see now investors asking for monthly or quarterly notice of the indemnification amounts paid. Many GPs will push back once again and ensure that there's some sort of qualification, either upon request or notification being subject to some materiality standard, either a monetary amount or a percentage of NAV. And on the fund of one side, typically we are seeing prior investor approval of indemnification amounts or payments, and then typically monthly or quarterly reporting of indemnification payments.
We next wanted to turn to a couple areas where we're seeing market movements in terms of funds and managers' desire to share the burden of liability with investors. And those two areas are direct indemnities contained in subscription agreements as well as investor givebacks. In the indemnification space, this is the only time in a commingled fund document where an investor typically has a direct indemnity in the fund subscription agreement. Typically, subscription agreements contain that direct indemnity where the indemnification obligation is triggered in two circumstances. One is for a breach of applicable securities laws or regulations. And the second is the investor's breach or an inaccuracy of the document that is provided. Now, historically, that would be just the subscription agreement itself, the investor questionnaire. But what we're seeing as a trend in the marketplace in commingled hedge funds is to include a breach or a misrepresentation or material inaccuracy, not just of agreements or representations contained in the investor questionnaire and in the subscription agreement, but also in any other document provided. Now, investors are increasingly concerned about this because the larger the investor, the more likelihood that there's control issues. They're concerned about what documents may be provided by various people on their investment team or other support team to the fund. They want to ensure that they're clearly identifying and understanding what other documents would be the subject of a potential indemnification claim. They want to control the accuracy, completeness, and the timeliness of any of the information being provided. Sometimes investors are saying, just delete that phrase. And managers have been responding in a variety of ways. Sometimes they reject that. Sometimes they will identify orally or give oral comfort as to what type of documents would be required so at least the investor can know up front. Or they are amenable to identifying and changing that phrase to include a specified list of documents. Managers have also indicated a concern that if there is a future law change, that they may want investors to be obliged to provide any additional documents to ensure compliance with those laws, particularly AML compliance. The second area where we've seen some market movement is in terms of investor givebacks. So investor givebacks, traditionally in PE funds, are very common. Under the Delaware law, in both the DROPA and the Delaware Limited Liability Company Act, there can be investor giveback obligations, but there's typically a limit of 3 years. This is particularly meaningful for investors in these types of funds where they make a complete withdrawal, and the three-year giveback obligation could apply unless the fund documents or other agreement with the manager indicates otherwise. In the commingled fund space, we have seen a trend toward the inclusion of some type of investor giveback in the fund document. Many fund documents don't include any type of limit on the investor giveback. A minority of funds will include some type of limit, whether it's a timing limit or an amount limit. When investors have requested that the commingled fund managers agree to some type of limit, oftentimes we've heard that there's been a concern about agreeing to it because, one, the giveback obligations are relatively new. Two, they don't want to agree to a specific limit with one particular investor versus another. In those instances where there has been agreement, it's usually a timing constraint. On the captive fund side, it's very different. Investors are insisting that there either not be any investor giveback at all or there's a limit. The manager rationale in the commingled fund space of investor fairness, so that if you made a complete withdrawal and a liability arose while you were an investor, you should share your pro rata share of the liability that was incurred while you were an investor. That doesn't apply in a captive fund space. The investors will demand that if I'm out, I'm not liable, sorry, you have to bear the burden.
Thank you, Chris. The most favored nation provisions, MFNs, continue to be a common feature in most side letters, particularly in the private equity area, but also in the hedge fund area. They're somewhat more difficult to manage because of the open-ended nature of the hedge funds. Creates difficulty in monitoring the various benefits and detriments of investors coming in and going out. But you still see them, and they typically, as in the past, will apply to seed investors early and large investors who will have a particular stake and ability to negotiate these provisions that will give them the comfort that they will not have been the second best negotiator of their investment into the fund. It also provides benefit for the managers and sponsors because they know that they won't have to go through endless negotiations of monitoring the differences among various side letters and trying to update them. You will typically in the hedge fund area, you'll see these MFN provisions, particularly focusing on differences in fees, calculations, amounts, timing. We'll also see a focus on liquidity, timing of subscriptions, and particularly withdrawals. So if an investor has a special right to a withdrawal, that might trigger the rights for other investors, as well as transparency at various levels. Often these are limited, particularly in the transparency area or some of the liquidity, to particular types of investors like ERISA investors or government plans, et cetera, that have special circumstances that give them very legitimate rights to special provisions. And often a side letter MFN will provide that a particular type of provision with respect to a particular investor won't apply to the extent that there are other investors that are differently situated. But the point here is that these continue to apply. It's hard to generalize about them because every MFN has its own particular flavors, but investors and as well as the managers should learn to expect them and to determine various strategies for dealing with them.
On the amendment front, when we take a look at amendments across the board, what we're seeing in the market basically are amendments broken down specifically into three different types of categories. One are amendments where there's unilateral action by the GP or the manager, and these are typically for either immaterial or insubstantial amendments, change in the fund's name, amendments necessary to cure any ambiguity, necessary to ensure compliance with applicable law. The second category is really consent of a majority of interest, amendments requiring the consent of a majority in interest. And these really are all other types of amendments, and amendments that may have a material adverse effect on all investors. And the third category are those requirements where amendments made require the specific written consent of each investor affected. And this may involve modifying the limited liability of an investor, reducing their withdrawal rights, reducing their capital account, increasing their management fee, or their performance allocations. Those types of actions typically require the written consent of each investor affected, and that's what we're seeing in the marketplace. On the fund of one side, fund of one investors typically will require prior mutual consent to any amendment. Now, there are some variations to that. We'll often see some fund of ones that allow for GP or managers to take unilateral action on their own for immaterial or insubstantial amendments. But more typically, amendments will require the consent of an underlying limited partner in a fund of one. So what are we seeing investors requesting with respect to commingled funds? Typically, we're seeing investors request that the GP or manager agree that the fund document shall not be amended either without the investor's prior written consent, which is rarely given on the commingled side, or that the investor be given the opportunity to withdraw from the fund as of a date prior to the effective date of such amendment without either being subject to a withdrawal fee or any withdrawal gate or lockup, or being subject to any suspension or other delay in the payment of withdrawal proceeds.
So what have we been seeing in the marketplace in terms of manager and GP's responses to these investor requests? Sometimes a manager will say, well, I haven't had an amendment to my commingled fund document. I really don't know how I would deal with that if an investor rejected it, if I needed their consent, particularly if a majority in interest consent was needed. Others will say, I won't impose an amendment on any investor that disagreed with it. So if they opposed it, I sought their consent, they were in the minority opposing it, I would allow them to get out. What we've been seeing is that certain managers have agreed by side letter or to amendment of the fund documents where they agree that any investor that disagrees with an amendment where a majority consent is needed would be able to withdraw prior to the effective date of the amendment. We're also seeing some varieties of that. Some managers are pushing back but giving other types of concessions. They'll say, well, you can get out after the fact and I'll waive the notice period, or you can get out monthly instead of quarterly. Alternatively, they'll say, if the amendment was to affect your withdrawal rights, those changes won't apply to you, so you can get out the next redemption date. Or alternatively, they'll say, if it affects any other type of right, if it's materially adverse to you, it won't apply. Otherwise, you can get out the next withdrawal date. So that's some concessions by managers.
Just a couple of quick notes and some trends we've noticed in other areas. I've had a couple of occasions recently when negotiating with investors on behalf of fund sponsors where the investors have insisted that the boards of the offshore funds be composed entirely of independent directors. And I've advised against that on the basis that, particularly in crisis situations, independent directors, because of their lack of stake in the business, often are reluctant to act with an expeditious approach that's required to solve these crises. And in fairness, they're entitled to their opinions of counsel, et cetera, but if you have an entirely independent director board, I've seen them not be able to act in that kind of expeditious basis. And so my recommendation has always been to keep a minority of independent directors, and the articles of the offshore fund or other conditions can allocate certain decisions to exclusively to the independent directors to avoid conflicts. But the point there is to avoid majority or entirely boards composed of independent directors. Another quick point on the Volcker rule. As everyone knows, this is a rule that was adopted a couple of years ago in order to reduce some of the risk-taking by banks. There's been a lot of confusion, particularly in the area of the application of Volcker to the hedge fund and private equity fund area. As you know, U.S. banks are not allowed to invest generally into hedge funds and private equity funds. They may, to a limited ability, sponsor them. Foreign banks can be also subject to Volcker if they have U.S. operations. They are allowed, nonetheless, to invest into hedge funds and private equity funds in the original concept, we had to provide that those funds could not be offered to U.S. persons or in the U.S. The agencies recently clarified that as long as the foreign fund is not also the sponsor of a particular private equity or hedge fund, then it may invest in that fund even though that fund is offered in the U.S. And that's relieved a lot of pressure in that area, and something that's important to note. Another interesting development we've seen, and you all may have seen this as well, we've seen investment managers and advisors reorganizing from the traditional LLC structure into a limited partnership structure. And I've gotten questions from a number of investors or others that say, you know, what is the deal here? Is there some regulatory change, et cetera? And as far as we're aware, the change, at least in all the examples we know, has been driven by some changes or at least some interpretations in the tax field that have made it clear that limited partners are not considered employees in the context of self-employment taxes, whereas there's doubt as to whether members of an LLC are employees or are effectively partners. And so some LLC managers have reorganized on the basis that if the owners are limited partners, they may not be subject to self-employment taxes. And that's why you may see this change. It shouldn't affect any of the duties and liabilities and obligations of the manager vis-a-vis its clients.
Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2015 8th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.